Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA, home of the Big 4-0 Birthday Bash, taking place Saturday, January the 28th. More information at WEAA.org, WEAA.org. WEAA turns 40 years old, so we want you to come party and play with us on that night. We have a panel here on this Martin Luther King Day, the same panel we had here 2 years ago in 2015, talking about the relevance of Martin Luther King's message to the world in 2015. President Barack Obama was still in the heart of his presidency, not winding down 3 days, 4 days away before he will no longer be president in the United States. Donald Trump was just still some strange person on television doing his apprentice program and occasionally running for president of the United States. Nobody took him seriously politically. It was a time before the consent decrees taking place in Baltimore that just happened here, and also all the reports around Chicago and Baltimore, and we'll be talking much more about that in the next hour. So we've asked that same panel to come back to talk to us about where we are now. That day, Diedrich Muhammad joins us. He's here again. Now he's director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative of CFED. And good to have you with us, Diedrich. Always good to see you.
Good to be back.
Dorcas Gilmore joins us. He's an attorney, consultant focused on economic development and part of the Black Worker Center here in Baltimore now. Good to have you back in the studio, Dorcas.
Thank you.
And Charlie Carter's here, who as then as now is director of the Maryland Working Families. Good to have you with us, Dorcas.
Thanks for having me back.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org by email. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. We know you all are off today, so we hope you're listening and will join us and don't have to hide your phone call from your boss. Just call in, 410-319-8888. You know, it's interesting when you think about King today, and I was thinking about King then, and, you know, in 65 when the Voting Rights Act came out and was passed, King at that moment was a really polarizing figure. Some stats I was reading. 45% of people rated him favorably, 46% negatively, right? And that was right about the peak of his popularity. And in 1966, the man who won the Nobel Peace Prize just 2 years earlier had a 63% negative poll rating. Only 12% of Americans expressed a highly favorable opinion of Martin Luther King. And half the white respondents believed that he was hurting the cause of black people. Only 36% thought he was helping. And now, of course, 84, 85, 86% of polls say that he was the greatest hero in American history, along with the founding fathers, right? And even whether you're conservative or liberal, everybody loves Martin Luther King. Yeah. Conservative talk show host saying, well, King would never have marched with Black Lives Matter. He would never have done that.
King was a Republican. He was hearing this all the time.
He was Republican. Yeah. Like all black folks were Republicans, right? Yes. So it was – but so it's a very different – something very different happens when somebody passes on and they become this legacy and this legend. And then we also forget the radical Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King who talked about reparations. Martin Luther King talked about socialism. Martin Luther King who talked about – the unity around with poor working people in America. People forget that King a lot in this. So, you know, when you think about where we were 2 years ago, how different is this King message for now for all of you here? Dorcas, go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's more urgent now than ever before. So the message is not different. It is exactly the same. And the focus, particularly the end of his life, on the need for working people to be in solidarity and to understand that black working people in particular are really the canaries in the coal mine. And I think that is what we have seen in this election, is that black working folks, we didn't hear a lot about black working class people after the election. We were really focused on white working class folks.
When you said the word working class, you meant white folks, not black folks.
That's right.
That was implicit.
Right.
And there wasn't any focus on the fact that black working class people voted differently than the white working class that was talked about in the media that actually wasn't that working class. But the focus on black working class folks as a linchpin, really, for thinking about economic justice and racial justice in this country was his message, and is still his message. This message still resonates today.
Yeah, I would say, I think, you know, a difference now is that, you know, 2 years ago, some 2 years ago we were talking, King is used as a hopeful figure, and in, I think, a more negative way, in a way to act like America has become post-racial. I mean, it's so oftentimes the picture of King is like we had bad racial inequality. King led the civil rights movement, and then the narrative is they won and race is behind us. And that was a narrative that was used, and I think was more digestible. Even in 2015, let's say, you know, it would probably be more digestible 2013, before the Black Lives Matter, before the police were regularly on television shooting black people. I think now, pre-Trump, we're seeing it's much more clear the hypocrisy of that, though clearly the hypocrisy was true in 2015. I mean, in that, you know, much of the basic racial, particularly racial economic inequality was not and is not on a path of bridging. It's on a path of widening. And we have these great chasms in this country. And I think the election of Trump has just, you know, further revealed that, but it was always true. So kind of like with Trump coming into office, everything has changed, but nothing has changed. It's not like racial economic inequality is worse. Police brutality is worse. We're worried about what policies will occur under a Trump administration. But I think it just helps give very better clarity as to the lack of progress that's been made in many aspects of racial inequality.
Charlie Carter.
Well, I think that the last 2 years have really, I agree with what Dorcas and Dietrich have said. I think the last 2 years, particularly with this election, have pulled back what I'll say is a veil. You know, there was a lot, I think we've been, as a people, content to believe to a certain extent that things were better. But I think what we see now is that we really are back in 1965, that things really haven't changed. That that you can still use dog whistle politics to separate working class people, and now more than ever with a concentration of wealth, which is far worse than it was in 1965, it is more important for white working class and black working class people to come together. It's more important to have a poor people's campaign and to address poverty and the concentration of wealth. So I think that if Martin Luther King were alive today, he'd be leading a Black Lives Matter movement, and to address, you know, not just criminal justice and racial injustice, but also economic injustice.
You know, one of the things that we talk about that era and now, it's interesting. I was looking for some old quotes of King's, and in 1964, probably people don't remember 1964, but I do. There was a man named Barry Goldwater who ran for president against Lyndon Baines Johnson. And for the establishment, there was this part of the way with the LBJ campaign that took place. And some people didn't even go with LBJ then, but it was part of the way with LBJ because Barry Goldwater was this really deeply conservative man who opposed the civil rights movement and many of the laws that were being proposed. This is what King said. While not himself a racist, Mr. Goldwater articulated a philosophy which gave aid and comfort to the racist. His candidacy and philosophy would serve as an umbrella under which extremists of all stripes would stand. So when I read that, you know, Charlie's not, you're not ahead. I mean, it's not far different than what we are facing today with Donald Trump's looming presidency. And what our response should be vis-a-vis where we thought King would be standing as well. I mean, you know, when you think about it, I don't know what's inside of Donald Trump's head and heart. Maybe he doesn't either. But you do know he has appointed people to positions like Jeff Sessions, who Coretta Scott King herself fought against his getting a judgeship in the 1980s mm-hmm. in a letter that's not been discovered mm-hmm. because he's just... I mean, is it blatant, racist, pro-segregationist, anti-voting rights? I mean, that's the umbrella that King was talking about.
That's the umbrella, absolutely. I think it goes back to what I said. I mean, when you think back to 2008 and when Barack Obama was elected, more white working class people voted for him than for any Democrat in history. He built this really progressive Democrat, I'll say, he built a coalition of working class people and middle class people who are all striving for the same thing. And then what we've seen over the last 8 years is a real determination to tear that coalition apart. And we saw that especially with Donald Trump and the use of dog whistle politics and the use of, you know, xenophobia and misogynistic comments that brought out the basest instincts in some people and tore that, really fractured that coalition. And now here we are, where he's set to put in some of the most conservative people to lead this government that we've seen in a while, certainly since Ronald Reagan. I think it's really incumbent upon us as the people to come together now and in a way that we haven't over the last 8 years to start pushing back.
I would just know. I don't know how much I believe. I have questions about how strong this working class coalition was that elected Obama. In that, I mean, I don't think the numbers were radically different in terms of, you know, white votes. I mean, like, Obama never got the majority of white votes, and I'm assuming kind of, and again, I don't know what we mean by working class, but I'm assuming the, you know, white working class was even less than the 40-something percent that Obama got. So, you know, I don't think there was ever this kind of multiracial, black-white coalition around for progressive politics that happened 8 years ago or 4 years ago. And I think in a lot of ways, the election of Trump was the Democrats' refusal to acknowledge who their base was. Trump was clear who his base was, and it's been the base Republican Party for the last 50 years. And it's the white voter, and it's not just the lower income voters, white voters. It's white voters, you know, generally throughout, you know, except for maybe youth. And I think the Democrats refused to focus on the kind of black, Latino, progressive white coalition, Asian American, Muslim American, what have you, that elected Obama the last two terms. And I think, you know, Obama, because of who he was, he didn't have to kind of focus on those issues in the same way that we might have expected a white candidate. But I don't think it's surprising that when you have, you know, a white 70-year-old, near 70-year-old Hillary Clinton, and a white vice president, and then be shocked that you didn't get your base out the same way that versus Trump, who was very clear on his base. So I just, you know, again, like, I don't think it's like, oh, some unique brilliance of racism of Trump that all of a sudden burst this coalition. This coalition was never that strong, and I think it was really more so a failure of the Democrats to focus on its base and its wanton belief that we're in some type of that they have some type of post-racial coalition that brings together all people on good ideas, goodwill. I think America is much more stratified than the Democratic Party wanted to recognize. Trump recognized it and used it to get into the White House. And I think, you know, progressives can't make the same mistakes that the Democratic establishment made in the 2016 election.
I think the only thing that I would add is that we're talking about this as though this is a U.S. problem. And this is actually a global phenomenon, that we are seeing both the rise of nationalism combined with a right, in many countries, a right-wing conservative agenda that shrinks the state, that yields greater power to the wealthy, and that it's really a part of a global failure of capitalism. And that we're seeing a part of that right now that is reflected in our politics, whether it's uprisings or election results. But I think thinking about this as not just a U.S. problem, because we're seeing it in countries across the globe, whether we talk about Brexit or whether we talk about the Philippines, whether we talk about Brazil, we are seeing a range of similar things happening that I think is very much connected to global capitalism and the fault lines that have always perpetuated the divide between those that have and those that don't. And the divide has only gotten, as Diedrich pointed out, greater, and as Carly pointed out, greater in the past generation in particular, But that trend is a global trend. It's not just a U.S. trend.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I really, I intend now to make a very serious study of the vote in this last election, because I'm not sure just how it really. I've seen so many different perspectives on who voted for who and how,
mm-hmm.
right? Not to get stuck on this point, I'm going to move on to some other issues here with King in today's world, but. A lot of the votes that Obama got from white working class communities, and he got a lot of them, especially union voters, went the other way this time. And race is clearly played a role in it, but so did their panic and fear over their economic condition and over what they see as their deteriorating lives. That, you know, I think part of what happened in 2008 was that a lot of people saw their hope and liberation symbolized by because of America, even if it was not totally a conscious thing, was embodied in a black man running for president. I think that was there's a lot of stuff goes on in people around race and art that we don't even know what's going on inside of us, and that kind of fueled Obama. But things didn't change the way people thought they changed. And I think that was part of it as well. So I don't know how it actually went. It divided out, but I'm not so sure that. That white working class, or if King was here today, he would say that white working class was the other side.
Was the other side of?
The other side of where the struggle is in this country.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I guess, I mean, again, like, I just don't know number-wise, really, what the big, I mean, I haven't seen a number of national white, like, what percentage of the white working class voted for Obama versus, you know, voted for Hillary or what have you. I've seen white votes, you know, nationwide, and
I have seen the majority of union voters, white union voters, voted for Obama.
Yes, but that's a small group of the white
working class.
And did the majority of union voters not vote for Hillary?
The majority of union voters did vote for Hillary, but the majority of union voters in America are not white.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Did the majority of white union voters vote for Hillary?
I don't know the answer.
What we saw in this election was that a greater number of white working class voters just stay home. And while Donald Trump brought out more voters that had never voted before, there's a huge number that just stayed home. And yes, unfortunately, I hate to say that, but Donald Trump probably got a lot of the white union voters. I think a lot of unions are dealing with that reality right now. I just mentioned it to say that what we saw in the 60s was a real focus on using race as a way of separating working people from challenging the wealthy and the powerful. And what we saw over the last 8 years is a real refocus on, you know, using that same strategy to stratify an electorate so that, you know, once again, working people were in a position to make big strides. And there were some big strides that were made under Barack Obama, healthcare being one. But once you start, pressing buttons and pulling at the strings, you saw that fracture in that coalition, then they were able to suddenly Obamacare was a terrible thing, even though more people have health care now, including the white working class who voted for Donald Trump. So that's really what my statement was about is that it was something that Martin Luther King warned us about. It was the direction that he was going with the Poor People's March of trying to bridge to put race aside to bring poor white people and poor black people together to push back against the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a few. And I think that we're at that point now where we have to fight that same fight, and the environment seems very much the same as it was in the late
60s. And King was never successful in that, right, in pulling together a plurality or a majority of white working class with, I mean, you know, like most of King's March, I mean, King's marches, people pull them together. It's a figure that brought together black, white. But I mean, even like it's the biggest kind of quote in success, the March on Washington, that was like a third white, right? I mean, in a third white of 200,000 people, is it doesn't show like he won, he had the majority of support of, you know, whites in this country. And I don't think he ever came close to that, and particularly even in organizing, right? So I'm not just, yeah. And so I'm just kind of highlighting that it's, I think we have to look at, and again, this isn't a dismissal of you don't look at white working class concerns. I'm not dismissing that, but I'm just saying, I think we get a little Pollyannish about this idea that we're around the corner is where, or that King was somehow, some person that was able to bring black and whites together when he was clearly a leader of a black organization. He was, his whole base was pretty much African Americans. He never had a strong, you know, he might have had some white donors, but he never had a strong white working class base.
Well, I think he was also cut off in the middle. The Poor People's Campaign was the last thing he was working on. And so he never did reach his pinnacle because his life was cut short, before that could really come together.
But so, no one has. I mean, who has brought together like this idea of a progressive, you know, white working class and blacks, you know, in large numbers? I mean, you know, you can get, you know, like maybe 10-20% or something like that. But no, when has that happened?
So let me let you jump in. I'll wait and I'll jump to the phone. Go ahead.
The only thing I wanted to add to this is that it is the historical perspective again, right? So it is also the case that this is a nation that was built on slave labor, mm-hmm. and the enslavement of Africans as the labor force, and the way in which free labor continued in this country was very racialized. And so when we look at the history of race in America, what we see is that race was always used as a mechanism to actually divide the interests of folks who otherwise would have had common interests, as the majority of Americans, particularly then, were poor. And so the use of race and the way in which the experiences, the enslavement, the level of discrimination against black folks has always been the strategy that enabled white working class people, white poor folks, to feel as though they actually had something that was better, that was different, that their white privilege enabled them to have something that was different than their neighbors, in many instances, who were black. And so I think, yeah, it's very difficult. This is a 4-century-old construct. And so I think the reality of the fact that no one has achieved it speaks to the entrenched structural nature of the way in which race is a part of the American economy.
And I think there are some real serious material differences, even between white working class
Absolutely.
And black working class,
Absolutely.
Even white poor and black poor, particularly when you look at things of wealth. But
well,
Absolutely.
I mean, then also, and then we're going to go right to the phones here, folks. I'm sorry, I haven't gotten the calls. I'm going to go right to the calls when we come back from this break. And it's going to be Leo and Robert, the first two callers up. I'm going to come right to you. But, you know, there's also, I mean, I was thinking about when King was in jail and he started talking to the guards who were all white and talking about how, you know, you should be out there marching with us. You're as poor as we are. So, I mean, I think poverty is poverty in this country. Poverty coupled with racism makes it more intense and worse. But poverty is poverty. If you're poor and living in West Virginia and living in Kentucky and you're white, or if you're poor and live in Southwest Baltimore and you're white, your chances of survival are not much better than anybody else's who's poor in this country. I mean, that's something we forget.
I bet you poor whites in Baltimore are a lot less likely to be shot than poor whites. I mean, than poor blacks in Baltimore, and same thing in Chicago. Like, so I don't think it. You know, it just, and two, there's real wealth differences. A white high school dropout has more wealth than African American with a college degree. So, like, again, like, there are even real material differences in how you live and the likelihood of being shot and all of these things, even if you look at, you know, lower income whites compared to lower income blacks. And I think, you know, that's part of the issue. I think it's part of the challenge is we act like they're all the same, that we don't wonder why they come together, but they're not. They're in different. Doesn't mean we shouldn't try to create a frame that can bring people together. I'm just saying I think we overly romanticize to our own detriment that, oh, if we just give, I think it's Hillary Clinton, we just give the right policy prescription. I think Hillary Clinton's policies were much better for most working class whites. But if if she's not able to message her information and share her information and connect with her working with a white working class base, and actually I would have argued that instead she should have focused much more on African Americans and Latinos. I think she could have flipped some states like Pennsylvania, like Michigan. So I think I think we overly want to see a post-racial America or America where blacks and whites and Latinos and Asians are coming together, but that's not the reality, and it's to our own detriment in terms of organizing.
We have to take a short break. We're going to come right back, and we go right to Leo and then to Robert. Stay with us.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
So that was King, Martin Luther King, talking about what we call today reparations.
Talking about getting a check, not just having a dream.
Right, right. Dietrich Mohammed's here, director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative of CFED. What's that stand for again?
Corporation for Enterprise Development, though we're going to change our name because no one understands what
exactly
that means. So you can say Racial Wealth Divide Initiative right now. People know what that means.
We'll do that. We'll knock that one out. Dorcas Gilmore, attorney and who's been involved in black worker development here in the city, but in the Black Worker Center here in Baltimore. Charlie Carter, who's director of Maryland Working Families, and you all at 410-319-8888. And Leo, you're on the air. Welcome.
Steiner.
Good morning.
And good morning to all of your guests everywhere. What a wonderful day this is when we reflect, Mark, on the courage of his convictions and the strength of Martin Luther King Jr. We've had other great leaders, but he just shines. He's a living example of courage that I think others need to try to emulate, and we're having problems with our hypocrisy and cowardice today in terms of rising up and fighting the good fight and to win the victory for poor and black and even the middle class. I'm reflecting on the white nationalist coalition that Donald, the actor Trump, was able to forge to succeed to become president. Again, he was able to bring together the rich white folks, and he always prides himself on being rich and white, the military-industrial complex, James Comey, the FBI director, who's come under investigation and who should be fired or resign, in my opinion. Donald Trump did a masterful job as a German-American and as one who emulates Mussolini and or Hitler, in my opinion, in forging this white nationalism, white unity. On the other hand, the Democratic Party hasn't done so well by virtue of its lack of courage and creativity. And I'm not looking just at white Democrats. I'm looking at the Congressional Black Caucus that never gave the President of the United States the support he should have in many regards, and who were very, very quiet when he proposed early in his administration the American Jobs Act and to bring people to work with correcting the infrastructural problems that face this country. And let me sign off with this note. Congressman Donna Edwards was deep sixed. She was terribly attacked and tortured by many people, not the least of whom were black people, who allowed themselves to be manipulated by the same forces that support Donald Trump. And now we've got John Lewis, Congressman John Lewis, coming under all this criticism because he decided to boycott the inauguration and Donald Trump. John Lewis has every right to take that stance. Why is he being criticized today for being courageous in doing what he thinks is best? That's my question.
Leo, good to hear from you as always. I mean, there are, I think at this point, 15, maybe 20 Democratic congressional representatives who are not showing up for the inauguration, including John Lewis, obviously. But John Lewis was up there. The attack on John Lewis by Donald Trump was, even made some Republicans wince, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, and, you know, a concern I have is that we make too much the issue around Trump and his bombastic and kind of all these weird things about his personality, and more so, and less about the policies that we think are hurting the country and the divisions that are hurting the country. And so, I mean, it's, you know, fine. You know, I get if people want to protest the actual inauguration, but I think we're more concerned about what are the policies and what is this country going to do, because we could very easily, and well, I don't know if easily, Trump could lose in 2020. But if he makes it that far, I think he probably will make it that far,
I'm not so sure,
and I think he could easily make it into 2024. But I think the issues are the policies that I think we all agree on, that with this greater concentration of wealth, racial wealth inequality is ongoing for blacks and Latinos and Native Americans. Are those policies going to be dealt with? Because even though a lot of people liked Obama personality-wise, his policies weren't bridging that racial wealth inequality. His policies weren't adequately addressing working class concerns. And I think that's the driver behind all of that. I mean, I think the hardest thing for Trump is that he said he's going to bring forth radical change that's going to address some of these issues. And I think we're going to see that he won't do that either. He might make it worse. But the question is, will that catch up to him by 2020 or not?
We can take bets on whether we think he's going to make it through. I think he's not going to make it even 2018, but we'll see. We cannot go backwards in time in terms of telling ourselves what we should do or not do. But I'm curious what we think that King's legacy, his resistance, the resistance he mounted, others mounted in that era, in SNCC and other places, the Poor People's Campaign, that resistance, what does it say about what we need to think about now, about the resistance and the push forward? Charlie?
I think it's a roadmap. I think we find ourselves at almost exactly the same crossroads that King found himself at today as in the 60s, and there's a roadmap laid out for activists now to follow, and that means that we need to see more people getting involved. That's the first thing, whether that's being part of Black Lives Matter or being part of any of the other movements that are growing, including the resistance to Trump, which I think plays a really important role, much mm-hmm. like the resistance to the Vietnam War played in the 60s as well. I think that is the young millennial, the progressive, white progressive wing, largely. And they're important. We need a coalition because no one group is going to be able to defeat Donald Trump or his policies over the next 2 to 4 years. I'm starting with you.
Dorcas.
So I'm not as optimistic on the 2 to 4 year side. But I do think the roadmap is part of it. The dedication to building grassroots power, the focus on directly addressing the challenges of black folks throughout the country, and understanding that what he ran into in Memphis was that in thinking about what does it look like on the ground, the experiences, the pain, the work challenges, that they shift from place to place, that Memphis is not Baltimore, right? And that going into a place, he faced several challenges going into Memphis because the strategy on the ground had already been developed, and he was being used to further galvanize, right? But that kind of focus on understanding that a community knows what it needs, that in order to develop the kind of resistance that's necessary at the local level and at the national level, that we have to start on the ground, grassroots building, and particularly Black folks building. So I agree with the coalition argument. I also think, though, that his life is clearly a testament to building Black-led organizations and the importance of that and the value of that within a coalitional space to hold ground on what it means for Black people to really achieve justice in this country. And so I think that roadmap of building from the ground up, of understanding that Black people's concerns are different, and that the in terms of the structure and nature of discrimination in this country, and that in order to build coalitions, we have to build from strength, that Black people have to be organized and able to speak for themselves, and then the coalition is one that is strong. And so I think that roadmap for resistance and a fearlessness and understanding that justice is only created by people who are willing to sacrifice.
So let me hit the phones here. And I do want to get some other folks, the people to join us here at 410-319-8888 and write to us here at talkatstandonshow.org by email. I think this is, I mean, it's a very complex piece. I mean, in some ways you can look at, I've been saying, as I said yesterday, when writers resist and the event they had yesterday, that I feel like we're like in a combination of 1932, when Adolf Hitler won with 32% of the vote, or 36% of the vote, and then the liberals, social democrats, socialists, and communists couldn't come together to take on Hitler, and then he began his genocide 8 years later. Or we're in 1877, when Hayes was elected president, and in this country destroyed Reconstruction, the last hope for real democracy. And it took another 10, 12 years of terror to institute legal segregation in America, that we are, but nobody can come together to do that. And one of my fears is we're not going to come together in America, that radicals and liberals are going to be at each other's throats, that Black and white folks are not going to be able to come together, other groups, and that we're going to be divided in our own little worlds. And this coalition around Trump is just going to waltz its way into power and remain there. I mean, that could easily, you know, that's why I wonder where King would be, or King-esque folk would be, in their confrontation with a system like this that is pushing back hard on all the rights that were taken.
And I just want to throw in, I mean, I think one concern I have is that I don't think we've looked enough about where King would have been during the Obama years. Because you have to remember, King was really pushing and was not getting popular opinion under Lyndon Johnson. Who put forward more progressive, you know, racial equity legislation than, you know, you could argue most any president, maybe in the 20th century, you could argue that. But King was the radical on that side. And I don't think we had that enough during the Obama years. I think people want to look for King when Trump's in office. Part of the problem was we didn't use King's blueprint when Obama was in office to push Obama further so that, you know, we might have been in a better positions of strength.
So I'm going to hit the phones here unless you want to jump in, Charlie.
No, I would just say that I agree with a lot of what you said. I think that that is my concern as well, that we are fractured. And I think King faced this problem too. I mean, he had real confrontations with SNCC, and they had a difference in the way they approached things, where SNCC was very focused, and Malcolm X, they were very focused on building Black power and grassroots. But King had a broader vision, which did include where he understood that it wasn't going to be all, he wasn't going to win with all a coalition with just Black people, talking to Black people, that he needed to bring in other people, because it wasn't the Black consciousness that he needed to change, it was the white consciousness that he needed to change. And so I think that we are faced with that now, where we need to, like, while there are many different interests and we are all very different, that we have to look at the greater fight. And the greater fight is, I can stand here and I can say that I'm a Black woman feminist and fight for my peace, but I will lose we will all lose if we don't have the ability to lower some of our, to find a common ground and a common vision and a common strategy to fight the common enemy.
But SNCC wasn't against working with white working class people. They just had a strong black power message. I just want to highlight, it wasn't like they, you know, and they believe whites should be organizing whites, right? And Malcolm wasn't only for black people. He believes in working with Latinos, Asian Americans, what have you. So it's a little more complicated than that, but I know you want to get to the phone.
Yeah, I comment on that too, but I'm going to let my listeners have at it here. 410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air.
Morning. How are you?
Good morning. Robert Burt, how are you?
I've heard so many comments from the speakers, so many insightful ones, and I'm beginning whether I have anything to say. Maybe I should shut up.
No, I don't think so, Robert Burt. Go ahead. What you got to say?
But with regard to the legacy of King, I think we have to think about especially looking at what's happening, especially post-Selma. You know, leading to, you know, the resistance of the Vietnam War, and very importantly, which you've brought up more than once, the Poor People's Campaign. We're going to have to do two things. I mean, we can't simply say we're just going to fight racism, we're just going to fight class, because we won't succeed in that way. So I agree with the speaker. A couple of you said that black people have to organize independent. We have to have our power base. I also agree with you who say that we won't win if we limit ourselves to that. So I tend to agree with this. It seems to me there are two things. I mean, Brother talked about how the inequality between races have continued to even increase. And it's been noted that class equalities have increased. This woman, Kyanga, her name, Yamada Taylor.
Yeah, Kyanga Yamada Taylor, right, from Princeton.
Is that
right.
The class inequalities in the black community have increased, and maybe a bit more rapidly in the racial equalities, and both have increased. We've seen right-wing Republicans in 2013 go to the Supreme Court to gut the Voting Rights Act. So we're not sure that we've definitively won the civil rights struggle, even in terms of legal rights. So we're going to have to defend that. We've got to fight racism. At the same time, we've got to fight this disease of economic exploitation, which is intricately interconnected and interwoven with structural racism. I think they feed off each other. And with regard to the whole question of coalitions, I mean, I don't know what to say. There's a significant part of the white population that we can't reach and may not be able to reach for quite some time. So we have to think about, one, building what we can in our communities, and also finding out what sections of the white, Latino, and other communities can we form a progressive coalition with so that we can move forward. Maybe some of the whites who at this point of voting Trump, maybe some of them can be brought to the census further down the line. But I think we need to begin with, I mean, if we're going to get anything started, you always have to ask, who can we connect with now? If we can do that, right, we may be able to also eventually draw another vote. But I think a kind of a battle for economic justice, for racial justice, for peace and against militarism and so forth, and economic exploitation, I think we have to build that now. And this has to be done both within and without the electoral process.
Robert, always good to hear from you. Look forward to getting you back in the air as a guest. Dr. Robert Burt, who wrote The Liberatory Thought of Martin Luther King, which was a really interesting book that he put together.
Well, that must have been. I should check that out. Yeah, that's interesting. One comment I have to make on what he was saying is, you know, see, I think it's part of a myth that puts you along a wrong path. The idea that we won the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. I mean, I don't think that was won. I mean, King was killed, SNCC was, Black Panthers were deconstructed, SDC, SDS was attacked. There were some victories in the 1950s, 1960s, but the civil rights struggle, the freedom budget of 1967 was never implemented. I mean, King didn't feel like that he was on the verge of winning. He thought we were on the verge of losing by the end of his life. So, it's a false narrative that somehow we won, and then how do we get to where we are? The fact is, we didn't win to create the socioeconomic conditions for racial equity, and that is why we're in the state that we're still in today.
And I'm not sure what we mean by winning either anymore. I don't know what the word win means, but I know what the word struggle means. I don't know what the word win means.
Well, and I would think it would mean creating institutions and structures that would allow for, you know, much greater socioeconomic equality. And we didn't do that. I mean, yes, there is no more segregated bathrooms. There's still segregated neighborhoods. There's still segregation as it comes to incarceration, right. I mean, murder rates, and these types of things. So we didn't win overall.
Dorcas, go ahead.
The only point I would want to add to what Diedrich is saying, it definitely is the case that structural racism has existed in this country for 400 years, and its manifestations are clear in housing and education and transportation, et cetera. And it is the case that we have made gains and we have lost them, right? That it does not, that it isn't simply that nothing has been gained or that there weren't some wins, right?
Sure.
We have made wins, and they have been taken away from us. And understanding that dynamic, I think, is very important. When we look at, for example, the public sector, that was a win for many African Americans, and as you would say,
being able for African Americans
to have access to the public sector,
be employed in the public sector,
and the public sector is still the number one employer of African American women and the number two employer of African American men.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that that was important is because it was a good job,
mm-hmm.
right? It was a job that wasn't just about making a decent wage, but it was economic security,
mm-hmm.
and it opened doors to a range of other opportunities. That was a win.
Mm-hmm.
What we are seeing now is the retrenchment of that win. Every time there is an attack on public sector workers, whether they are local or state or federal workers now that are going to be under extreme siege, that is an attack on the Black community. And so to me, the issue of race and class when we talk about Black working class people is obvious. And it provides the platform for building with other folks who are in the similar position, which happens to be the vast majority of America.
And to agree with Dorcas, I just want to say real quick that, I mean, it's true. African Americans managed to win to start getting into a middle class that was being deconstructed by the late 1960s, 70s, and then the 80s even more so. And so I do believe there is some common things that we can fight for, because I think that is an issue. As African Americans were getting civil rights, we had these victories as the middle class started to be weakened by 1970s and definitely 1980s. But I didn't mean to cut off.
Charlie?
Now, I really appreciate what Dorcas just said, because it's not just the attack on the public sector, it's also the attack on unions. The Black middle class was able to expand when they were able to get into union jobs as well.
Absolutely.
And that provided also job security and benefits and a pathway forward that was much more equitable than with previous to unions. So as we continue to see, and I think that will be at the very top once the Republicans get rid of Obamacare, that the next target will be organized labor. I think that is an attack on the Black community. I'd like to focus on that we really, now is a time that we really should be looking at that roadmap and that was laid out and trying to figure out how we move forward. I agree that with what Diedrich said, that we made gains, we lost gains. We lost those gains. I don't think we've won because I don't think the struggle is ever finished. But I do want to highlight things that are going on. I think William Barber's Moral Monday movement, which is spreading across the country, has once again shifted the focus to engaging people around poverty and dignity and equity. And that movement, we're seeing, you know, it's multiracial, it's Black-led, it's clergy-led, but I think that's a direction that Martin Luther King would be, that's a movement that he would be engaged in. And I'm happy to say that we're, you know, Working Families here in Maryland is trying to build that same Moral Monday Maryland movement, because I think it's the opportunity for people to plug in based on their values and not just on their political ideology or around specific policies. And I think that we that's the point at which we have to start appealing to people. So what are your values? What are your morals? And start organizing people from there. I think that's the direction that as a country we need to start moving into and look at what the big picture is, because if we need to start pushing back against what we perceive to be the threats coming from the new White House.
It's a new White House. Oh, my God. Every time you say that, I just get this shudder goes down my spine about, you know, I've never before in these 24 years in the air have I ever felt so partisan in terms of what must be said when you say things like that. It's just, this is a very, to me, very frightening moment in American history that we're about to face. Before we get out of here, I wanted you to have a chance to talk about what's happening today.
So I just wanted to underscore what Charlie was saying in terms of the resistance and making sure that we are focused on the fact that we can create a moral economy and a moral society, and that addressing structural racism has to be at the core of that. Today we are having a Black Worker Town Hall at 2 p.m. at Coppin State University, and it will be the first public event of the Baltimore Black Worker Center.
So what is the Black Worker Center of Baltimore Black Worker Center? What
so we are building a base of Black workers by doing three things. Research, so state of Black workers in Baltimore will be a series of reports that we will release. The second piece is base building and outreach. We've been surveying Black workers at Mondawmin, at markets, and in churches to understand what exactly is the current crisis and challenge that we're seeing with Black workers today. And then thirdly, we are focused on worker education. And so providing Know Your Rights at Work trainings for workers in a variety of places. The aim is to build the grassroots power of Black workers to advocate for change in our workplaces as well as in our communities, and the fight is about racial and economic justice.
That's important. I'm glad that's taking place. I mean, I know you have been working and organizing on this for a while now.
Yes,
right?
And it takes a minute to get a group, but we are strong and moving forward now.
And there's nothing more in the King line than doing a Black Worker Center, right? I mean, looking at the King's work and what he was doing. So I think that's really exciting when King's national holiday, at least, that the Black Worker Center is being opened. That's exciting.
Yeah, and I think we have a lot of discussion to have here in terms of where the struggle is going and what to do and how you – how in the spirit of what we learned in the 60s fits into 2017, fits into this 21st century, you know, and what the strategies are moving forward. My personal thought is I don't think that Martin Luther King would be sitting quietly by watching this go on, whether if he was still alive at 88 years old. Mm-hmm. And I also got to remember that we have to think about young people, younger people, and listen. King was 26 when he helped lead the Montgomery bus boycott. Mm-hmm. He was 39 when he was assassinated, yeah. As was Malcolm. Mm-hmm. So these were young voices of men and women in their 20s and 30s that were making this movement happen. Mm-hmm. Not people my age or people in their 40s or 50s, but people who were young and leading that struggle. And sometimes we kind of dismiss the voices of young movement leaders and radicals and thinkers and activists. I think we have to remember just how old people were when the movement and these struggles were actually taking place.
Yeah, Kim was the old man fighting the young people by 34, 35, right? He's fighting SNCC, the young whippersnappers.
Oh, no, because in SNCC, yeah. You have to remember that many people in SNCC didn't have a lot of respect for Martin Luther King back in the 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Gloria Richardson, as I was telling folks earlier, in 1963, when we were in Cambridge, Maryland, she asked King not to come to Cambridge. Mm-hmm. We don't need you here. We got this. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our own radical message here we're doing in Cambridge. It's always, you know, this history's complex.
And that doesn't mean disrespect, but that could mean also acknowledging sometimes, you know, sometimes where the young people are organizing is not where the old people need to be at that moment. I mean, and that doesn't mean that they can't work together in other ways, like Stokely Carmichael and Martin Luther King. Stokely Carmichael had respect for King, but they did some different things. And
they were very close.
Yes.
I mean, they were personally extremely close. And so anyway, this has been a great conversation. Dietrich Muhammad, director of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative, Dorcas Gilmore, organizer of the Baltimore Black Worker Center, and an attorney here in town, Charlie Carter, director of Maryland Working Families. Good to have the three of you in the studio. It was a great conversation. And happy MLK Day. Let's remember the man and the struggle and keep on going forward.
Thank you.
And speaking of going forward, we have to go into our next hour. We have to take a short break and come back. We're going to look at this police consent decree. What does it mean? Stay with us.